Smoke and Pearly were over at Timber Notch, preparing to leave on their hunt for whoever had raided the ranch. Pearly was sitting on the edge of the porch of the Burke house, already into the little bag of donuts Sally had made for him. Tom Burke was cinching up the saddle on his horse, while Smoke was kneeling by the steps of the porch, studying the dirt. Reaching down, he picked something up, then examined it closely.
Well now, looks like they didn't get away clean.
What have you found?
Do you have a shotgun in the house?
Yes, a double-barreled Greener 10-gauge. At first, I thought maybe they stole it, but I found it out by what's left of the barn.
Did you keep it loaded with double-aught buck?
As a matter of fact, I did. Why?
Because this shot is double-aught buck. And if you look close enough, you can see that they're bloodstained.
So one of them is wounded?
I doubt that. Whoever caught a belly full of bullets is more than likely dead.
I hope so.
There's something else about these pellets. This thread was sticking to one of them. It's red and black.
Red and black thread? Came from a shirt, maybe?
That would be my guess. But the question is, what would an Indian on a raiding party be doing wearing a white man's shirt?
Well, that doesn't seem all that unusual to me, Smoke. Since they've all started getting paid for allowing grazing on their land, most of the Indians have more money than most of the cowboys I know. They buy all sorts of white man's things.
Well, that's true. But let's think about this for a moment. These Indians were out on a war party, right? Now, it's been a long time since any of our Indians around here were hostile. They've got no reason to be. It's like you say, most of them are making more money than most of the cowboys as it is. So the only reason I can think of that Indians might be on the warpath would be for some holy reason known only to them. If they're going to war for some holy reason, then they'd want it to be in the old way. That means they would paint their face, wear feathers and traditional warrior getup, and to tell the truth, I have a hard time picturing a warrior in a red and black plaid shirt.
Maybe they aren't out to make medicine. Maybe they're just out to steal what they can.
Are you missing anything, Tom? Anything that the Indians might want?
The only thing that was taken was that gold chain and diamond I had given to Joe Allen. You remember it, don't you?
Yes, of course I do.
Well, that was gone, but nothing else was missing. Not any of the horses, not even the shotgun. Come to think of it, none of the guns were taken from my hired hands, either.
Have you thought about that?
Sort of curious, isn't it?
Very curious. I mean, here we find arrows all over the place, which means they were armed with bows. Wouldn't you think they would want to replace their bows with guns?
So, what do you think all this means?
I believe it means someone wants us to think it was Indians.
Think we'll be able to follow the trail, Smoke?
I don't see why not. They didn't make much of an effort to cover it up. Let's see where it leads us.
The sun was high overhead at Sugarloaf, a brilliant white orb fixed in the bright blue sky. Pig Iron McCord, Jason Harding, and Dirk Wheeler looked down on the ranch from atop a nearby hill. As they watched, a woman came out onto the back porch. There, in broad daylight, she took off her shirt and would have been naked from the waist up had it not been for the fact that she was wearing a camisole.
Look at that.
The woman poured water into a basin, then began washing her hair.
Is that Jensen's woman?
Well, who else would it be?
You think she's alone?
Of course she is. If there were some hired hands here, you'd think she'd be out back on the porch damn near naked.
What is it? What are you laughing about?
I'm laughing about Jensen. He's out there looking for us, and we're here with his woman. You know what? I think I'm gonna enjoy this more than I would have enjoyed killing Jensen back in town.
We gonna take turns with her, aren't we?
Yeah, we are gonna take turns, aren't we? I mean, I ain't planning on just standing by and watching you have all the fun. I figured to get in on this too.
Oh, don't worry, you will. We'll take us turns. Long as you boys both know I'm first.
Sally looked at the pile of towel she had brought out onto the back porch with her. Under the top towel was a loaded pistol. She looked at it to reassure herself by its presence. Then, without being too obvious, she checked the progress of the three riders who were coming toward the house. What Pig Iron and the others didn't realize was that Sally and Cal knew they were there. A few minutes earlier, Cal had gone up into the loft of the barn to push down a couple of bales of hay. While he was up there, he just happened to walk over and stand in the attic opening to have a look back toward the distant tree line. He didn't know what made him walk over there or what made him look, but whatever it was fortuitous, because that was when he saw the three riders coming. The way they were approaching, avoiding the road, staying back in the trees, and never crossing a hill in silhouette, told Cal that whoever the hell they were up to no good. He hurried to the house to tell Sally.
Cal, do you think you could manage to get around behind them without being seen?
Yeah, I think I can. I can get across to the ridge line before they're close enough to see me cross in the open. Ridge will give me cover until I reach Bushy Draw. But then they'll be beyond Bushy Draw, which will put me up behind them.
All right, you do that. And while you're sneaking around behind them, I'll do something to keep their attention here.
Cal hurried back to the barn, saddled his horse quickly, then rode hard to get across a field that would let him go along the backside of the ridge. He figured to come back down behind him about the time they hit the edge of the south pasture. Sally decided to get their attention by washing her hair. And to make certain that she kept their attention, she upped the ante a little by taking off her shirt. It would also give her the opportunity to carry a pistol outside without anyone knowing that she had it, by slipping the revolver in between the towels. In the meantime, Cal reached Bushy Draw, a pass through the ridge line. Bushy Draw was so well protected by vegetation that unless someone knew it was there, they would never see it. In fact, even knowing it was there, one had to be right on it to see it. Because of that, Cal was able to get within 20 yards of the riders, close enough to hear them talking.
They said she was a good-looking woman. I reckon I just didn't know how good-looking she was until I seen her.
Hell, Wheeler, what difference does it make to you whether or not she's a good-looking woman? I've seen you with women that were so ugly they'd gag a maggot on the gut wagon.
Yeah, but just once. I'd like to have me a good-looking woman.
Well, you boys better enjoy her while you can. I don't aim to leave her alive.
You gonna kill a good-looking woman like that? Why? Seemed to me like we could take her with us. That way, anytime we wanted to, why, we could just take our pleasure with her.
Nah, she'd just be getting in the way all the time, and I don't aim to leave her here where she can talk.
Yeah, I reckon you're right.
Cal pulled his pistol.
You fellas just hold it right there.
What the hell? Where'd you come from? Who are you? What's it to you?
Cal's bullet clipped Harding's earlobe, sending out a misty spray of blood and leaving a bloody wound.
Are you crazy, mister?
If somebody doesn't answer me real quick, I'm gonna take off another earlobe. Only I'm gonna let you three guess which earlobe it'll be. Am I gonna take your other one? One of yours. Now I'm asking again, who are you?
A fountain of blood squirted up from the neck of Cal's horse, and the animal went down on its front knees, then collapsed onto its right side. The fall pinned Cal's leg under his horse. He also dropped his pistol on the way down, and now it lay just out of reach of his grasping fingers.
What the hell? Who's that shooting?
Huh? Who the hell cares? Look at him. He's pinned down.
Harding drew his gun. Though Cal's right leg was still pinned, he was able to flip his left leg over the saddle and lay down behind his horse, thus providing himself with some cover. Harding's bullet dug into his saddle and sent up a little puff of dust, but did no further damage.
I can't get to him from this angle.
Come on, let's get the woman and get out of here.
Not till I put a bullet in him. That son of a bitch shot off my ear.
Cal made one more desperate grab for his pistol, but it was still out of reach. His rifle, however, was in the saddle sheath on the side of the horse that was on the ground, and Cal could see about 6 inches of the stock sticking out. He grabbed it, grateful when it pulled free.
Goodbye, asshole.
The smile left Harding's face when he saw the business end of Cal's rifle come up.
He got Jason!
Let's get out of here!
They didn't even bother to look back to see what happened to Harding. In the meantime, the distance rifle fired again. When Cal located the source of the shooting, he saw a mounted man with one leg thrown casually across his saddle. Using that leg to provide a stable firing platform, the shooter raised his rifle to fire again. Looking around, Cal saw Sally riding hard toward him.
No! Sally! Get back!
The distant rifleman also saw Sally approaching, and his next shot went toward her. Cal watched with alarm as dust puffed up from her hat, and he was sure she'd been hit. He was greatly relieved when she reached his fallen horse, leaped down with a rifle in her hand, and slapped her own animal on the rump to get him out of the way. She dropped to the ground behind Cal's horse.
Thank God you weren't hit. When I saw that bullet hit your hat, I thought you were a goner.
The bullet hit my hat? Oh my, that was very close, wasn't it? We've got to get you out from under that horse and over on this side.
Cal tried to pull his leg free, but he couldn't. Then he got an idea. He stuck the stock of the rifle just under the horse's side and grabbed the barrel. Using the rifle as a lever, he pushed up and wedged just enough space between the horse's flesh and the ground to allow him to slip his leg free.
Is your leg broken?
No, I don't think so. The blood circulation was cut off and now it's numb.
Let's try and make it over to the dry stream bed.
Crawling on their bellies, Sally and Cal slithered and twisted their way down to the dry stream bed. They reached the bank and rolled over behind the berm just as another bullet plowed into the dirt beside them. Then they twisted around behind the bank and looked back up toward the place where the shots were coming from.
Well, with this cover and the rifles, we aren't easy targets. And if he tries to come any closer, he'll be playing with our deck of cards.
The shooter, whoever he was, come to the same realization because he put his rifle back in the saddle sheath, then turned and rode away as casually as if he were riding down Main Street. And why not? There was no way Cal and Sally could reach him from where they were. As Pig Iron and Wheeler got close to the rifleman who had rescued him, they recognized him, and he was easy to recognize. His skin shone black in the sun.
Jim, what are you doing here?
Tatum sent me after you.
What does he want?
He didn't say.
Well, I'm glad you come when you did. I reckon we owe you.
Jim, always a man of few words, didn't answer. Pig Iron and the others rejoined Tatum just before dark that night. Tatum was sitting on a fallen log near a fire eating beans. He looked up as they arrived.
Find out anything?
Yeah, they raised an army. They were by the name of Covington's leading it.
Covington? Lawyer?
Yeah, lawyer.
Well, what do you know? My lawyer leading the army. Wow. Well, this couldn't have worked out any better if I'd planned it.
Tatum looked around as if just noticing that someone was missing.
Where's Harding?
Pig Iron and Wheeler glanced at each other, hesitant to answer.
I said, where's Harding?
We run into some trouble.
What kind of trouble? I told you to lay low when you were in town. Last time you were there, you got yourself whooped by Smoke Jensen, as I recall. So what happened? You run across him again?
Not exactly.
Not exactly? What the hell's that supposed to mean?
Well, Jim was there, weren't you, Jim?
Jim just stared at Wheeler with an absolutely emotionless expression.
Oh, well, I can just see the kind of fracas Jim might get into, him being black and so talkative and all. Now, I'm gonna ask you one last time to tell me what happened to Harding.
We went out to Smoke Jensen's ranch.
Oh, did I tell you to go to his ranch? No! What I said was hang around town and see what was going on.
I know you didn't tell us to, but I figured maybe we could find something out there, too.
Oh, bullcrap, Pig Iron. You figured you'd get even with him for beating you up. Hell, I don't blame you none for that. Truth is, I'd like to see the son of a bitch dead myself, and when this is all over, I may just arrange that. So did you kill him?
Oh, he wasn't there. There was no one there except his wife and a hired hand. Just a kid.
Well, did you kill them?
No.
Wait a minute. Let me get this straight. There was no one there except Jensen's wife and kid. But Harding is the one who wound up getting himself killed.
Oh, yeah, that's about the size of it.
Well, what did Jim have to do with it?
Well, the kid, He got the drop on Harding.
He got the drop on Harding?
Yeah, he got the drop on Harding, and when he did, well, he sort of had us over a barrel, too. He was gonna kill Harding unless we give up to him.
So you let him kill Harding? Yeah, well, yeah, I could see that. Two for one, that's a pretty good exchange.
This wasn't at all where Pig Iron was going with the story. But when Tatum accepted it this way, Pig Iron looked over at Wheeler in a silent suggestion that they let him believe his version.
Yeah, that's exactly the way it happened. Then old Jim here come along with his rifle and he killed the kid's horse. He gave us a chance to get away.
Get away? You didn't kill the kid?
No, Jensen's wife was coming by then and she had a long gun and we only had pistols. We didn't have no choice but to leave.
Some miles away, Smoke, Pearly, and Tom Burke were also sitting around the fire. They had eaten well tonight because Smoke had killed a turkey and the aroma of its cooking still hung in the air. Tom was cleaning his .52 caliber Spencer rifle.
I'll be damned. You still got that rifle?
Yep.
What rifle?
The rifle he made the shot with.
The shot?
You mean you've never heard about the shot? The shot that won the Battle of Adobe Springs. How far was it, Tom?
Well, they measured it later. Said it was 1,200 yards.
Oh, wait a minute. Are you trying to tell me he made a shot from 1,200 yards?
At least that far. To tell the truth, it looked even farther to me.
To you? Well, wait a minute. You were there, too?
Oh, yeah. I can't believe I've never told you this story.
No, but I have a feeling I'm gonna hear about it now.
Tom was a buffer then. From time to time, I would do a little of it myself.
A buffer?
That's what was called buffalo hunters. Anyway, about 15 of us just happened to wind up in a stage depot along Adobe Springs.
As Smoke told the story, he did so with such vivid imagery that Pearly could almost see himself in the little adobe trading post where the 15 buffalo hunters had come together. It was early in the morning and Smoke had just awakened. Spread out all over the floor, the little stage way station, were the bedrolls of other buffers who had gathered there. Some of them had whiskey, and one of them had a guitar. In addition, there were two women passengers from the stagecoach, headed for Denver. They were saloon girls, known to nearly all the buffalo hunters, so most had stayed awake, drinking and singing far into the night. As a result, nearly everyone else was still asleep in the morning. Smoke went outside to relieve himself when he saw a large group of mounted Indians advancing slowly toward him.
Indians!
Barricading the door, Smoke ran to the window and looked outside. The Indians weren't approaching as they normally did, either by stealth or by riding back and forth. Instead, they were heading straight for the building in a massive charge, their horses leaping over obstacles, feathered bonnets flying in the breeze. By now, everyone in the building had responded to Smoke's warning and rushed to the windows. The opening salvo was devastating. Half a dozen Indians went down. Stunned by the unexpected volley, the Indians withdrew about 200 yards, then formed for a second attack.
Anyone get hit?
Yeah, Johnny got hit, but I don't think he's bad.
I'll look after him.
Jo Ellen was the more attractive of the two prostitutes who had come in on the stage. The Indians came again, three abreast this time, galloping through the dust. They charged all the way up to the building, firing from horseback, shooting arrows and bullets in the cracks between the logs. They hurled lances toward the open windows. Two of them jumped down from their horses and tried to force the door open by hitting against it with the butts of their rifles. Once again, the buffalo hunters took very careful aim, making every shot count. Several Indians went down, and their riderless horses whirled and retreated, leaving their riders dead or dying on the ground behind them. The rest of the Indians waited a few minutes, then launched a third attack.
Here they come again!
This time, however, the Indians made a much more traditional approach. Using a stone wall and a barn as cover, they were almost on top of the defenders before anyone could get a shot at them. The Indians fired through the windows. Three more of the defenders were hit, including Lily, the other woman.
Oh, Lily!
Jo Ellen sat on the floor and held her friend's head in her lap. Suddenly, fire arrows came streaking in through the window, starting several small fires.
Get him out, quick!
Grabbing blankets and rugs, the defenders managed to beat out all the arrows but one, which continued to burn out of control.
We're gonna need water!
One of the men grabbed the water bucket, and with it, finally got the upper hand over the last fire arrow.
Oh, was that our drinking water?
Yeah.
Oh, we're gonna get awful thirsty.
Where's the well?
Out there.
The man pointed to the well out in the front yard. Anyone who went after water would be completely exposed to the Indian.
I'll go!
Speaker, no!
Speaker was out before anyone could stop him, and he dashed across the open space toward the well. Watching through the window, Smoke saw a puff of dust fly up, then a gush of blood spurt from Speaker's shirt.
I wish he hadn't done that.
Yeah, he should have thought more about it. He never had a chance.
That's not the only thing. Now the Indians know we're out of water. All they have to do is wait us out.
That's exactly what the Indians did. They didn't launch another attack. Instead, they waited just out of range. The afternoon grew long and very thirsty, aggravatingly so, when the Indians, who had plenty of water, would appear just out of range and pour gourds of water over their heads. The Indians didn't leave during the night. From every window, the defenders could see their campfires.
Oh, we gotta have water. I'm going out to get the bucket.
You won't make it.
I might. It's dark. They might not see me.
Do you think they don't know we need water? You saw how they were pouring water over themselves today, tantalizing us. They're waiting at the well for anyone who's crazy enough to try.
We gotta do something. We can't make it another day without water.
How long can we last?
Maybe another day.
Tom looked out across the open ground toward the ridge where the Indians were. Though the fires had mostly burned down, he could still see faint glowings here and there. There was also enough of a moon that he didn't think the Indians could sneak up on him, even if they wanted to.
You're going to think I'm crazy, but I'm glad this happened. That is, if I live through it, I'm glad it happened.
Well, I don't know as I think you're crazy, but that is a curious outlook.
I reckon it is. But I am to change my life after this. I don't plan on being a whore anymore.
Good for you.
What about you? You plan to go on being a buffalo hunter?
Doesn't make much difference whether I plan to or not. There aren't many buffalo left. Truth is, I'm gonna have to get into some other line of work pretty soon.
You ever thought about ranching?
Thought about it. I wouldn't mind owning a ranch, but I don't think I'd care to cowboy for someone else.
I own a ranch.
What?
That is, I own some land. It's out in Colorado. A friend left it to me.
He must have been a good friend.
He was.
Have you ever seen it?
No, but I know it's there. The county clerk sent me a letter describing it to me. And I've kept the taxes up. You aren't married, are you, Mr. Burt?
No, I'm not.
You think you can marry someone who was once a whore?
Joellen, are you asking me to marry you?
I reckon I am. That is, if we get out of here. The way I look at it, we're both going to be making some big changes in our life. Seems to me like it might be easier if we made those changes together. I'm sorry, I had no right.
No, you don't understand. I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing because I never thought anything like this would happen to me. Yes, I'll marry you.
Shortly after dawn, when everyone was awake, Tom told the others that during the night, he and Joellen had made plans to get married.
When?
As soon as we get out of here.
Well, then you're both gonna die single, because there ain't no way we're ever gonna get out of here. Them engines out there is just gonna wait us out till we either die of thirst or just start going crazy and running toward the well.
Maybe not.
Well, maybe not. What do you mean, maybe not?
Well, I've been doing some thinking.
Tom walked back over to the window and looked out toward the Indians who were still there on the distant ridge. He studied them through a pair of binoculars and took two large caliber bullets from his bullet bag. Separating the bullets from the cartridges, he began pouring the powder from one of the cartridges into the other cartridge.
Say, what are you doing?
I'm double loading a shell. If you take a look through those glasses, you'll see some fancy dressed son of a bitch up there giving orders to the rest of the Indians. Seems to me like if someone was to kill him, the others might go home. So, that's what I plan to do.
You mean the next time he comes down here?
No, I mean now.
Well, hell, man, that's 1,000 yards away if it's a foot. What are you talking about?
Light that candle for me, would you?
Shaking his head, the man lit the candle, then handed it to Tom, who tapped the bullet back into the cartridge, then used the dripping wax to help seal it. After that, he loaded his rifle, then stepped back up to the window.
You're just wasting a bullet.
Maybe not.
Wait a minute, are you saying you think he can do it?
I've seen him shoot. He's got a place to rest his rifle, and the target is right up on top of the ridge line. Yeah, I think it's possible. At least it's worth a chance.
Tom picked up the rifle then and rested the barrel on the windowsill. He aimed, then lowered the rifle and adjusted his sights, lifted it up, aimed again, then lowered it for another adjustment. No one said a word. Tom aimed a third time.
You missed. I told you you couldn't...
Wait!
Huh?
You got it!
Everyone rushed to the window then to watch as far in the distance the fancy-dressed Indian fell from his horse.
Yeah, they left after that. All of the Indians turned and rode away.
And the woman? Wait a minute. You said her name was Jo Ellen. You mean that's where you met Mrs. Burke?
Yes, Pearlie. Jo Ellen was a former whore. But I will tell you this. No man could have ever asked for a better woman.
The Comanche village was near the Purgatory River, and for this reason, the little settlement was called Purgatory by the white men, though not by the Comanche. The Indians had no specific name for their village. It was just where they lived, a part of them, and they would not think to name it any more than they would give a name to the water they drank and the air they breathed. Here, an old chief sat in the center of a circle of men, women, and children.
Listen, and I will tell you the story of the Comanche.
Those who were around him, including the elders of the council and the young men, drew closer to hear his words. The one who held the attention of the others was Stone Eagle, the traditional chief of the Comanche. Stone Eagle was an old man who had fought many battles when he was younger. Because of that, he had the respect and admiration of everyone in the tribe.
Once, there was a young man. He was not Comanche. He was not Kiowa. He was not Crow. And he was not Lakota. He was before. He was in the time of the beginning, before the winter counts, when men could speak with animals and the spirits of the earth, fire, wind, and water. Now, the young man did not even know this was unusual because he had always been able to do so, and it seemed a natural thing for him to do. Then, one day as he stood watching an eagle fly, he thought that perhaps he would try and fly too. So he leaped into the air and he beat his arms like the wings of an eagle. But he could not fly and he fell to the ground. Whomp! Foolish one, you cannot fly. That's what the eagle taunted. And he soared through the air and he laughed at the young man. Then the young man saw a coyote running swiftly, so swiftly across the plains, and he ran after the coyote, thinking to catch him, but he couldn't. Foolish one, do you think you could run as swiftly as I? That's how the coyote mocked him. Then the young man saw a bear. The bear smelled honey in a comb that was high in a tree, and the bear, with his great strength, pushed the tree over so he could have that honey. The young man was very impressed with the bear's great strength, so he too tried to push a tree over, but he could not. The bear, who was enjoying his honey, saw the young man, and he teased the young man and called him a weakling, and he told him he had no business trying to push over a mighty tree in the first place.
Stone Eagle shook his head sadly.
Oh, that young man felt very bad. He tore out his hair, and he gashed his face with rocks, and he cried out in anger and in despair. He said, I cannot fly like the eagle. I cannot run as swiftly as a coyote, nor do I have the strength of a bear. Why am I on this earth if I cannot do any of these things? Suddenly, the young man heard a strange sounding voice carried on the wind. Go to the mountains. That's what the voice said. The young man climbed the mountain, and as he climbed, the voice in the wind continued to speak to him.
You are a worm. You are a blade of grass. You are an ant, a mote of dust. You are nothing. You cannot fly. You cannot run swiftly. You have no strength. Climb to the top of the mountain.
Why should I climb to the top of the mountain?
You will know why when you get there.
The young man began to do as he was instructed, but he did so with a heavy heart. He believed that the voice had instructed him to climb the mountain so he could jump off and kill himself. So he was frightened and sad, but he felt that he must do what the voice told him to do. And as the young man climbed, a strange thing happened. He grew hungry and looking for something to eat. He saw the buds of the peyote cactus. He ate the peyote buds, and as he did, he began to see things he could not see before. He was no longer frightened or confused or ashamed. Only truth remained in his body, and with truth, he understood all. It was true he could not fly like an eagle, but an eagle could not use his wings as hands. It was true he could not run as swiftly as a coyote, but a coyote could not walk upright. And it was true he did not have the strength of the bear, but the bear could not make poems or music or dance to the rhythm of the drums. When the young man reached the top of the mountain, he thought of all this, and he spread his arms wide, and he looked over the valley far below.
Why don't you jump?
The young man looked around, and there he saw a warrior wearing many feathers and shining as bright as the sun. Some say it was he who is called Shining Warrior, a messenger from the Great Spirit. And that is what I believe.
No, I will not jump. I am not a worm. I am not a blade of grass. I am not an ant or a mote of dust. I am a man.
Now, your period of trial is over. Now you have the gift of the peyote and the sacred wisdom. And from this day forth, you will be the master over all the animals and all the things of nature. You shall have a name, and your name shall be called Comanche. And your people shall be many, and they will be mighty hunters and warriors.
The young man left the mountain and returned to the valley below. When he returned, he discovered that all the animals had been struck dumb as their punishment for mocking Comanche. The animals could no longer speak to him. They couldn't speak to each other either, and every animal had to go for all time after that, unable to even speak to their own kind. For it was intended for man to rule over the animals. As the years went by, Comanche took a wife, and he had many children. And the children took wives, and they had many children, and those children took wives and had many children. I am the child of one of those children, just as you are the children of my children. And that is why we are known as Comanche.
After Stone Eagle finished his story, there were others who told stories as well. If the story was to be a story of bravery in battle, the one who spoke would walk over to the lodge pole and strike it with his coup stick. Then everyone would know that he was going to tell a story of an enemy killed in battle. Such stories were only told by the older men of the tribe, for it had been a long time since the Comanche had been in battle, and none of the younger men could make such boasts. In stories of this ilk, the enemy warriors were always brave and skilled, because that made the warrior's own exploits all the greater. Now, not all of the stories were of enemies killed in battle. Some of the stories were of hunting exploits, and these stories could be told by the younger men. Some stories were even of things that had happened in the time of their father's father's father, which had been handed down through the generations to be preserved as part of their history. One of the men who had listened intently to all the stories was Quintana. Quintana was the nephew of Stone Eagle. Though as Quintana's father had died many years ago, Stone Eagle was more of a father than an uncle. Quintana, a handsome man with a broad chest, powerful arms, and strong legs, had listened to all the stories because he hoped to find, in one of them, the answer to a troubling and recurring dream. In the dream, Quintana had seen many people walking through a pall of smoke. The people were weeping, but they were not weeping because smoke was in their eyes. They were weeping from sadness. Quintana asked why they were sad, but he always awoke before anyone could answer him. At first, Quintana was disappointed because he didn't find the answer in any of the stories. Then, as he thought about it, he realized that maybe he had. The story of the Comanche was the story of the origin of the use of peyote buttons. Only once before had Quintana used the peyote. Perhaps if he used it now, he would understand the meaning of this strange and disturbing dream. That night, before he went to sleep, Quintana mentioned his dream and what he had decided to do about it to his wife, Sashina.
Does that mean you will not go with the hunters then?
Oh, do you think I would stay here only to listen to the stories the others will tell when they return? Were I to do that, Tekana would have me believe that he took every animal with his bare hands. No, I will make the hunt. Then, when I return, I will seek the knowledge of the peyote.
Smoke Jensen stopped at the edge of a grassy meadow where he saw hoof prints. Then, seeing some elk droppings, he squatted to get a closer look at them. The droppings were soft, which meant they had been made less than an hour ago. That meant the elk was close by, more than likely in the clump of trees just ahead. Smoke knew that the elk would think himself safe in the woods, but those same trees would also allow Smoke to get closer without being seen, provided he made no noise as he approached. For most men, that would be difficult or impossible. But Smoke had learned from the old mountain man preacher how to choose his steps so carefully that he could walk on a carpet of fallen leaves without being heard. He knew, too, to stay downwind of his prey. A small bush, its limbs bare but for a few brown leaves, rattled dryly in the wind. The bush stood just on the edge of the open meadow, the last piece of vegetation between the woods and a small, swiftly running stream. Smoke was certain that when the elk left the woods for water, it would come this way. Smoke crouched behind a rock and waited. He had been there for about 30 minutes when he saw a bull elk's head stick out from between a couple of trees. The animal stood perfectly still for a long time, its eyes sweeping over the open meadow, its nose twitching, its ears cocked. That elk was not about to commit itself until it had examined every possible danger. Moving as slowly and quietly as he could, Smoke raised his rifle to his shoulder and took aim. The elk started out into the open. It moved slowly and cautiously down to the edge of the stream, then it stopped. The elk's head popped up, its rack held high. It stared for a long moment, remaining perfectly still as it did so. Smoke held his breath. The creature's eyes twitched. The elk listened. then decided that whatever it had heard represented no danger. It stuck its head down into the stream and began to drink. Smoke sighted down the barrel of his rifle, finding a target just above and behind the elk's left foreleg. At almost the precise moment he squeezed off his shot, he thought he saw something flying out of the trees toward the elk, but the white puff of smoke that billowed from the end of the rifle barrel so obscured his vision that he decided what he had seen was nothing more than a trick of the light or a moving shadow. The elk fell to its front knees. It got back up and tried to run, but could go no more than a few steps before it fell again. Smoke got up and ran across the open field toward the still twitching elk. When he reached the animal, he stopped cold and stared at it in surprise. It was lying on its left side with its legs stretched straight out in front. Sticking up from just behind the right foreleg was an arrow.
It is my kill!
When Smoke looked toward the sound of the voice, he saw an Indian coming toward him from the edge of the woods. He was tall for an Indian, and he was wearing traditional Indian dress.
My elk.
No, it was my shot that killed it.
My arrow.
Smoke turned the animal over, then pointed to the bullet hole.
My bullet.
They were quiet for a moment. Then Smoke offered the Indian his hand.
I am Smoke Jensen.
You are Smoke Jensen?
Yes.
I've heard of you.
The Indian stuck out his hand.
I am Quintana.
I have heard of you, Quintana. By the way, there is a way to settle this if you're interested.
Yes, I am interested. What is the way you would settle this?
Well, I'm looking for meat, and I reckon you are too. And the way I look at it, half of an elk is better than no elk at all. We could cut the animal in half.
I want the front half, and I want the heart.
All right, you can have the front half.
I will cut the elk in two pieces.
Quintana dropped to one knee beside the slain animal. He took out his knife and began cutting.
Why are you hunting with a bow and arrow?
We wanted to make this hunt in the way of our fathers and their fathers.
If you went on the warpath now, would you go on the warpath in the way of your fathers?
Warpath? Why would we go on the warpath now? The days of war are over.
For you, perhaps, but not for everyone.
Yes, I've heard of the Sioux and their ghost dancers and medicine shirts. They think they can bring back the buffalo, but I know they cannot.
No, I'm not talking about the Sioux. I'm talking about the Comanche.
It is not true. There are no Comanche on the warpath.
Perhaps some who are renegades. Evil young men who have left your village.
I know where every young man from my village is. Why do you ask this?
Because recently some Indians attacked a ranch. They killed everyone on the ranch. The rancher's wife, his children, and those who worked for him. Then they burned the barn and the outbuildings.
And people think we did it?
The arrows did have Comanche markings.
I do not understand this. It is not good that a white man's ranch was attacked. It is not good that people think Comanche attacked the ranch.
So you're telling me you know nothing about this?
I know nothing.
I didn't think you did. Truth to tell, I thought all along it might be someone else. Comancheros, perhaps, who wanted to make it look like Indians attacked.
Yes, that would be smart. They could take what they wanted from the ranch, but people would think it was the Indians.
No.
No?
That is the strange part. The people who did this took nothing. They only killed and burned.
Such people I do not understand.
By now, the elk was in two parts, and Quintana stuck the knife into the open cavity of the front half. He carved for a moment, then pulled out the elk's heart.
Make a fire. We will eat the heart together.
Good idea. I was getting a little hungry anyway.
While Smoke made a fire, Quintana found two forked sticks. Then he peeled the bark of a third stick and used that as a skewer for the heart. With the flames dancing, Quintana placed the skewer across the forked stick so that the heart was in the fire. Within a few moments, the juices dripping into the fire from the roasting heat perfumed the air with their aroma. Smoke and Quintana talked of inconsequential things until finally Quintana stood up and carved off a piece of the meat. It was too hot to hold in one hand, so he passed it back and forth between his hands as he gave it over to Smoke.
Here, I have some salt.
Smoke took a little paper envelope from his pocket. He gave a pinch to Quintana, then salted his own meat before he took a bite.
It is good.
Yes.
To eat the heart of the animal you kill is a good thing. If it is a male animal, you will have his strength and, that which makes him a male.
Oh? What if it's a female?
Do not worry. From the female, we get courage and cunning. And that which makes us male is not harmed.
I'm glad of that, for I have eaten many female elk and deer.
The two men finished eating the heart. Afterward, they held their hands up to each other in the sign of peace. Then each took his half of the elk and went his own way.
Would you mind telling me how you managed to kill half an elk?
Smoke had ridden back into their camp, carrying the elk's haunch.
And the back half at that?
Smoke told Tom and Pearlie of his encounter with Quintana.
You sound more than ever convinced that they didn't have anything to do with the raid on Tom's ranch.
Practically the whole tribe is out on some sort of ritual hunt. They don't even have any weapons with them, except for bows and arrows. If they were the ones who had attacked the ranch, they sure wouldn't be wandering around without guns.
I think Smoke's right.
I almost wish I wasn't right.
Why's that?
Because if we were after Indians, we would have at least some idea of what we were up against. Now, we don't know. The only thing we know about whoever did this is that they're pure evil.
Camp Covington, as Covington called it, was located just outside Big Rock. There, in a wide meadow, tents were pitched and a military camp was born. Covington had insisted that all those who signed up leave their houses and ranches and hotel rooms in order to come together as a military unit. Covington had absolutely no military experience, so he knew nothing about drilling. However, Marcus Dingo, who Covington had appointed as his first sergeant, did know drilling, and he spent a couple of days whipping the troops into shape. This was particularly rewarding for Dingo. Dingo was the kind of man who had a difficult time hanging on to a job. As a result, he was often unemployed, which meant that sometimes he had to accept the most self-demeaning of tasks just to keep body and soul together. When he was sweeping the barroom floor or emptying the spittoons, it was easy for the others to make fun of him. Now the situation was changed. As first sergeant of Covington's company, Dingo was someone who could and did demand and receive respect from the same men who used to tease him. For 3 days, Dingo drilled the men, taking special delight in making life difficult for those who, but a week earlier, had regarded him as their inferior. Finally, the next day, the march officially began. The march continued on through the day. Because they were a newly activated unit, poorly led and with no economy of motion, the march was difficult and tiring. For 20 minutes of every hour, the men dismounted and led their horses for 10 minutes, then let them rest for 10 minutes. For miles upon miles, Covington's cavalry moved toward the Purgatory River, on which was located the Indian village that Covington was convinced was responsible for the raid on the Burke Ranch. Finally, just before nightfall, a stream of water was found, and Covington gave the order that this would be their bivouac. A handful of hardtack crackers supplemented the coffee and served as their supper. While the men were eating, Covington sent Dingo ahead on a little scouting expedition. Dingo returned less than an hour later with word that he had located the village.
Good. We will attack it tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Yes. We'll hit them just before dawn. I want to catch the heathen redskins before they get out of bed.
Even though all its young men were gone, leaving the village virtually defenseless, the people of the village were enjoying the peaceful sleep of the innocent. They were completely unaware that less than 200 yards from the village's outer ring, in the lower reaches of a great pine forest, Shadows were emerging from the darkness, and that these shadows represented danger to them. The emerging shadows were the men of Covington's militia, and they began to take up their positions around the village in accordance with Colonel Covington's instructions. The horses moved silently, with only their movement and the vapor of their breathing giving any indication of life. It was cold in the pre-dark dawn. Colonel Covington and his staff officers moved to the crest of a small hill to stare down at the Comanche village. All the teepees appeared to be tightly shut against the cold, and no one was moving anywhere. Wisps of smoke curled up through the smoke vents in the top of all the teepees, and the smell of wood smoke mixed with the aroma of last night's cooking. Clear indications of habitation.
Are you sure the Indians who raided Tom Burke's ranch came from Purgatory, Colonel?
Normally, Captain Roach was teamster for a wagon freight line, but he had joined Covington's company of Indian fighters.
Of course they came from Purgatory. This is the closest Indian village, isn't it?
Well, yes, sir, but that's my point. It just don't seem likely to me that they would crap so close to their home nest.
Did it ever occur to you that is exactly what they want us to think? What do you think about it first, Sergeant?
I figure it's more than likely these here Injuns is the ones who done it. But even if it ain't these, don't matter. Because once this here war gets started, all Injuns is going to be the same.
I think you are right, First Sergeant. Captain Roach, how long will it take you to get your men to the other side?
Half an hour.
Then get your men into position, Captain. It looks like we have caught them completely by surprise. And I want to attack before it's light.
Yes, sir. Colonel, what about the women and children in the camp? By attacking while it's still dark, I'm afraid we'll be putting them at great risk.
Will we now?
Yes, sir.
What about the women and children at Mr. Burke's ranch? Were they at risk?
Yes, sir. I guess I see what you mean.
Once your men are in position, fire one shot. That will be our signal to attack from both sides.
Yes, sir.
The horses and men were now in position. They stayed motionless for several minutes.
All right! Attack, men! Attack! Remember the Burke Ranch!
At Covington's orders, the militiamen galloped forward from both sides of the Indian camp, firing as rapidly as they could at the conical teepees that rose up in the darkness before them. It had been so long since there was any battle between Indians and whites in this area that many of the Indian residents of the village hadn't even been born then. Because of that, the sleeping villagers had no instinctive responses to call upon. They poured out of the teepees not to join in the fight, but to see what was going on.
Keep calm, men! Keep calm and fire low!
Though the Indians were totally surprised by the unexpected attack on the village, they realized quickly that they were in mortal danger. Many of them tried to run, only to be cut down by the gunfire. Sashina had awakened as quickly as the others, and when she moved to the door flap of her teepee to look outside, she saw the swirling melee of soldiers and Indians. At first, she was as confused as everyone else in the village. Then, looking around, she saw Stone Eagle going toward the soldiers, holding an American flag over his head.
Do not shoot! We are friends to the white man! I am a friend of Grant!
Stone Eagle was shot down within 20 yards of his teepee. Grabbing a robe, Sashina wrapped it around her naked body. Then she picked up her baby and left the teepee, running toward the edge of the tree. Two soldiers on horseback galloped after her. One of them reached down and grabbed the robe, then jerked it away.
I'm a damn! Look at her! She's naked!
Hey, she ain't bad looking. Well, get the kid away from her. Get the kid away from her, we'll have us some fun.
No!
Hell, don't fight her and just kill the damn kid.
Using the butt of his pistol, the first soldier hit the baby in the head, crushing the skull.
Now let's see what this old Indian gal can do for us.
The other soldier dismounted and came toward her, unbuttoning his pants as he did so.
Oh, what the hell?
A bullet hit Sashina right between the eyes. Ed looked around to see who'd shot him. He saw Dingo.
We're here to kill Injuns, not make some half-breed brats who we'll have to deal with in the future. You want a woman? Get yourself a whore like everyone else.
Well, there ain't nothing says we can't have a little fun now.
Yeah, there is something that says that. Me, I say it.
The First Sergeant is quite right.
Covington had arrived to see what the discussion was about.
We are here to conduct war against these people, not commit rape and other atrocities. You will conduct yourselves with dignity. Now, get on with it.
Oh, yes, sir.
Very soon thereafter, the shooting stopped because there were no more targets of opportunity. Covington held up his hand and his men circled together. The ground was strewn with Indians.
All right, men. I congratulate you on a fine victory here today. Surely this will go down in history as one of the greatest Indian battles of all time. Now I want you to search all the teepees and remove anything of value, especially any weapons that you might find. And bear in mind that you are liberating contraband, not for yourself, but for the entire company. We will make a fair and balanced division of plunder once we return to Big Rock.
Some of these people are still alive. What do we do about them?
Shoot them, I guess. That would be the humane thing to do. No sense in letting them lie here and suffer.
What about the teepees?
Burn them.
For the next several minutes, the men of Covington's militia moved through the encampment, removing blankets, cooking utensils, knives, furs, and anything else of value they could find, including, in several cases, money.
Colonel, I suggest that we not stay around much longer.
Why is that?
Have you noticed that there are no young men among the dead?
What are you suggesting, Captain?
I'm saying that for some reason, all the younger men are gone. If they come back from wherever they are and they see us with all this, they aren't going to take it very well. And we would be very vulnerable right now.
A most astute observation, Captain Roach. Very well. Give the order to withdraw back to Big Rock.
Oh, yes, sir.
A few minutes later, with most of the teepees burning behind them, Covington led his militia back into the woods from which they had come. The bodies of 137 old men, women, and children lay on the ground, while the fires of scores of teepees sent a large column of smoke climbing into the air above them.